I have the copies of slides. See if it helps in following any better. So the main topic for today is bounded length planning, and essentially what we will do is we will start with graph plan, and I discussed how the graph plan algorithm, I mean you can use search on the planning graph directly. We'll start from there, and we will notice that in fact you can directly search on that graph to find the solution, as we discussed last time, and then notice also that it can be compiled into SAT or CSP or IP, and then depending on the time we can also get rid of the crutch of planning graph, and notice that if all you're interested in is finding a k-length plan, you can always write a set of constraints such that the solution to those constraints would be a valid plan, and it will ultimately, it's just a question of solving those constraints, you know, writing those constraints in some standard form, either SAT or CSP or IP, and solving them. Okay, and then we'll talk also about what does planning graph add from that point of view, and by the time all that discussion is done, you should understand this slide. Okay, you can't understand this slide now. If you understand this now, you can leave right now itself. Basically, you know whatever I'm trying to tell you. But essentially, that is the set of connections that you need to understand. These are all different techniques that came up, you know, almost as if they are unconnected, but they're all essentially connected by that picture. Okay, so that's what we're going to do as far as the main topic today is concerned. But before I get there, I wanted to say a couple of things about the search heuristics for plan space planning. That's from last class discussion. This, in case you were wondering, this was like this picture. The whole point of this picture was that. After graph plan and after graph plan came along, which we'll be discussing today, and then you found that in fact the planning graph of graph plan can be used as heuristics to drive any planner, and then we found that in fact you can use that to drive the state space planners in particular. Essentially, up until that point, every planner that was being published and talked about and published. By the way, can you guys see, or shall I put off that light? I have been awake yesterday. I mean, it was triple AI deadline. How many of you are awake until 12 o'clock? Okay, so that's what triple AI means. And I'm old and I cannot stay awake, so I'm actually, my worry is if I put off the lights, I'll fall asleep. So I know that's why I'm keeping lights. In fact, I wanted to have that sun lights also on. But if you can't see it, let me know, I'll put off this light. So the point was that most of the planners up until 1995 were essentially partial order planners. Okay, everybody was writing partial order planning algorithms and improving them, writing all sorts of heuristics about them. So if you see the literature of planning around 1995, it's all about partial order planning. And then once around that time, planning graph-based heuristics were invented. This guy is Drew McDermott. You'll keep hearing about him. He's one of the more interesting and quite smart senior members in the community. Um, So he essentially wrote this state space planner, regression planner, state space regression planner, and started thinking seriously about search control for it. And that looked like heresy, because why would anybody other than dumb people go back to state space planning? Okay. And yet, from 1995 until close to like end of, until 2000, state space planning was the only game in town, and you know, essentially people decided that planned space planning is dead. Okay. You know, this is how these things are, right? I mean, people work on whatever that's interesting, and so we wrote this paper saying, in fact, the same heuristics that can be used for state space planning can also be used for planned space planning. Okay, so at least you can make planned space planning competitive with graph plan, and which was considered like unbeatable at that point of time. Okay, so here was a partial order planner which was using the same planning graph based heuristic to kind of compete with graph plan. Okay, so that sort of puts things back in the same place even now, actually. So what was interesting is 2 years after this, maybe 2-3 years after this, in the planning competition, somebody entered a partial order planner, a plan space planner, into the competition. And it was, by that time, people have forgotten how plan space planners work, because they've only been looking at, you know, state space planners and SAT plan, graph plan, sorts of things. And they were surprised that it actually worked, and that it, you know, it didn't win the competition, but it was respectable. So it was given the Best Newcomer Award, which is kind of very weird, considering that it was the old comer. It was what was being done in, you know, before 95. But between 95 and 2001, people have forgotten enough about it that when it actually started working again, you know, it was the Best Newcomer Award. Anyway, so that's about just a small, like, the way the different planning technologies were, you know, up and down. My general feeling is that the reason you should understand techniques other than just the one that is currently working is because unless you can prove that some techniques are dominated and can never actually recover, in a course you should understand everything. Okay, in writing your paper you pick whichever planner you want. Okay, but in a course you want to understand, because you never know which idea would actually make sense. So imagine the people around 1995 who just thought, you know, state space planning is such a, you know, elementary idea, I shouldn't worry about even considering it. And, you know, that they would have been wrong, because in fact they actually do quite well. Okay, so now what is hard about applying reachability heuristics to planned space planning? The tricky part, of course, is the notion of reachability is best defined in the space of states. You're talking about how far is one state from another state. If you remember the last time, that heuristic that I was discussing last time was essentially saying that you can, you know, do just full progression. Here is a set of notes in case you want. You can do full progression in the context, and then you can know the perfect distance. Right, but then if you want to do relaxed distance, if you want just an estimate, you can do this, you know, combine all the states into a single proposition list and then do the planning graph and then start bringing back negative interactions later on, which is what we were discussing last time. Right, so all of that sort of makes a lot of sense from the states point of view. Okay, so given progression planners have states going in the forward direction, regression planners have states going in the, you know, reverse direction. The tricky part about planning, plan space planning, is it doesn't look like there are any states. In fact, that's considered the, if you have a partial plan, right, you can always bring in new actions which come in between the existing actions. That was considered to be the flexibility of plan space planning. It's not either a prefix nor is it a suffix. Okay, so because of which it becomes harder to actually talk about, you know, any state associated with the plan. Okay, however it turns out that if you, for example, in one of the things that we did was try and ignore negative interactions in the state space planning and just use positive interactions and use a heuristic for that. Okay, suppose you ignored negative interactions in plan space planning. One interesting question is the following thing. If you have a partial plan, if you remember plan space planning, whenever you have a partial plan, you have a set of open conditions. If there are no open conditions, that means essentially there may be a couple of unsafe links, otherwise the plan is done. Okay? So if it's not yet done, it's because it has a set of open conditions. Now open conditions are part of the preconditions that need to be achieved. Okay? So it almost looks like it's like a regression state. And you need to know how far is that state from the initial state. Okay? Do you understand what I'm saying? So you can think of the set of the open conditions of plan space planning, plan space plan, a partial plan in the plan space planning, as just sort of like a regression state. But not quite. Because in regression state, it really is a state. You need all of them in the same time point. In plan space planning, the open conditions might be such that I need this condition here, this condition here, this condition here, this condition here. So if you look at this particular plan, for example, it has a bunch of open conditions. There's a P there, there's a R there, there's a Q there, but then P is only needed here, Q and R are only needed here. And they are not in the same state. So actually, if, you know, in general, you know, if I need to, for example, have, you know, a bunch of money tomorrow, and then I know a set of, you know, a couple of bags of chips day after tomorrow. Okay, that's not a single state right now. Okay, suppose if I bring the, you know, money as well as chips, you know, bags of chips today itself, I might eat them up today itself, so I won't have them day after tomorrow when the game is in progress. Actually, day after tomorrow. Okay, so in general, the problem is that if I just make everything true in the beginning, right now, then it may not actually persist to where it is needed. However, if I ignore negative interactions, then whatever I need, I can have it in the beginning itself, and it will persist because nobody eats chips anymore. Nobody uses up the money. So if I would need money tomorrow, chips day after tomorrow, and some paint, you know, 2 months from now, I can get all of them now itself, and then with no cost, just persist them where they are needed. So ignoring negative interactions essentially makes set of open conditions of a partial plan exactly equivalent to a regression state. Once it's a regression state, you just use planning graph to compute its cost. Okay, so the idea then is that, so this is what this is saying, if you ignore negative interactions, then the set of open conditions can be seen as a regression state. That was the whole point. And it's because there are no negative interactions, what you got can never be eaten up. I mean, chips can't be eaten up because once they're there, then, you know, nobody is negating anything. I mean, nobody is, you know, violating any conditions. Okay, so this would be used, so in the, if you have a queue of partial plans waiting to be expanded, you would pick the partial plan that has the set of open conditions which is closest to the initial state. Presumably that's because that would wind up requiring the least number of actions that you need to add to the plan such that the plan becomes correct. That's the idea. So that was the main thing actually that, you know, winds up helping partial order planners. Okay. The second thing that helps, in fact, we did that, but it's sort of a slightly different idea, is if you do have negative interaction information, in particular, if you have negative interaction information saying that two conditions are always mutually exclusive. Okay? So P and Q are always mutually exclusive. It's not. So when I said that actually you have to differentiate between temporary mutexes and eternal mutexes. Okay, a temporary mutex essentially is two conditions might be mutually exclusive at a level I. But then as you grow the planning graph, they become they're no longer exclusive. That means there is no I-length plan such that can make both these conditions true. That's all temporary mutual exclusion means. Okay. Now, two conditions are permanently mutex or eternally mutex if, in fact, you know, they're always mutex. So there is no level at which the mutual exclusion goes away. Okay. By the way, one interesting thing, actually, again, to combine, connect it to something that we discussed last time. Remember, we said you could have a planning graph is a redundant data structure, and that, in fact, you can consider instead of having this action list, proposition list, action list, proposition list, you can just have one set of actions, one set of propositions, such that you remember the level at which the action came first and the level at which the proposition came first. Now, if you have mutual exclusions, what would you need to remember about the mutual exclusions? For actions and propositions, you need to remember the level at which they came in, because once they come in, they never go out. What about mutual exclusions? How will you remember them? In the planning graph, what's interesting about mutual exclusion? So the thing is, once they go, they're gone. Do you understand what I'm saying? Mutual exclusions essentially are always present. So in the beginning, you assume that every pair is mutually exclusive. Okay? If two propositions are not mutually exclusive at level I, then they must be not mutually exclusive at level I plus 1. Agreed? So if you could do both of them in level I, then it should be possible to also do nothing so that they will be possible in I plus 1. Yes? That's a good point. So, yeah. Okay. But I won't even repeat it. Okay. So, as far as mutual exclusions are concerned, all you need to remember is when they go away. Okay. Now, that means if they don't go away, that means they are actually eternal mutexes. Okay. Now, that also brings up the issue. If you have a planning graph and you are generating a planning graph, right? If you just, you know, grew it to k levels, and at the kth level, p and q are mutex, does that mean that they are permanently mutex or they are temporarily mutex? So when will you ever find out, based just on the mutual exclusion propagation, that some things are permanently mutex? For that, there was a question that we never directly answered in the class, but it was written up in a book, and in also probably we discussed it, you know, you may know this from previous course, that one idea is you grow the planning graph until level off, until, you know, between two levels nothing has changed. Now, what does nothing has changed mean? If you are not using mutual exclusion, then if between two levels, if the propositions haven't changed, right, then no more new actions can come in, and so there is no point in extending it any further. And similarly, if you are using mutual exclusion, if between two levels no more mutual exclusions went away, that means the exact same set of mutual exclusions are there between the two levels, so nothing went away, okay, two consecutive levels, then you can stop growing the planning graph at that point of time. And whatever other mutual exclusions that are left then are going to be permanent. Okay? That's the idea. So anyway, so this basically brings up this permanent or eternal mutexes. They can be computed in other ways too, but one way of computing them is just by mutex propagation in planning graph. Okay? Now suppose I tell you these permanent mutexes. Then if I know that P and Q are mutually exclusive, now in the plan space planning, if you have a causal link for P and somebody is doing not P, then it is an unsafe link. But if I just prove to myself that P and Q are mutually exclusive, then I argue that this particular link right now is threatened. You may not realize it, but it's threatened, all right. Why? Because if I essentially have S1, right, is giving P to S2, and Sk is giving Q, and so it can potentially come between S1 and S2, right? It can potentially come between S1 and S2. And if it ever comes between S1 and S2, then there must be a state where P and Q must have to hold together. You don't know where that state is going to happen. It could well be that in this plan, there may be more steps that will come between S1 and S2. But you know that this causal link is going to make sure that P is true from here all the way to here. Which means whatever state that you go through here, P will be true. And in one of those states, SK would have already interceded. So it would say Q is true. And so that is not possible. P and Q can't be true together. Which means even though it doesn't directly come and say not P, it is as good as saying not P. So you now essentially detect indirect conflicts, not just direct conflicts, which are P and not P, but indirect conflicts such as P and Q, where Q is a negative, is a mutual exclusive with P. Okay. Now, having done that, in fact, you know, that in itself is a useful thing, because any indirect conflict that you detect is cutting down, you know, so once there is a failing node, and if you don't recognize it, you would expand it and become many more failing nodes. Okay? So any indirect conflict you detect, you may as well take care of it right away. Okay. Now, what does taking care of it right away mean? In this particular case, actually, in you know, the way it was done in this work that we did previously was to throw in a disjunctive constraint. So rather than say promotion and promotion one branch and demotion another branch, you can essentially say here is a disjunctive ordering constraint that is thrown on top of the plan. And then once you have a disjunctive ordering constraint, you can do constraint propagation. So if I say S1 is before SI, SK is before SI, or SJ is before SK, and if later on I find that SI is before SK, then so P or Q and not P implies Q. So that's basically propagation. Okay. So the bigger thing I want you to understand is that this you used with positive interactions, you could then convert what is plan space planning where there is no state, such that there is actually a state which is this, you know, equivalent to regression state, and you can use a reachability heuristic. And then here, if you do mutual exclusion analysis, especially the permanent mutexes, you could use them. Okay. So that's slightly different use of the reachability heuristics in plan space planning. And as I said, the performance of plan space planners with reachability heuristics is not comparable yet to that of progression planners. But neither is it bad enough that you don't even consider comparing them. Okay? It also allows us to say that reachability heuristics can be used for any kind of planner. Maybe the trade-offs as to, you know, the effectiveness might depend upon the actual search strategy. Okay. Any questions on this? Okay. Like I said, I'm going to do today go from where much in the first several slides essentially is going to be a quick repetition of what I already mentioned last time, which is that if you take a planning graph like this, and if you do at the minimum, all you need to do is mark the static interferences between the actions. As soon as you mark static interferences between the actions, that means actions that are mutually exclusive because they, one of them requires P, other requires not P. One of them gives P, other gives not P. Okay? So if you just use those kind of actions, statically mutually exclusive actions as in, you know, mutual exclusive, so you mark those mutual exclusions, okay? Then all you need to do is look for a subgraph in this planning graph such that that subgraph basically supports, you know, the first level actions, the last level actions support the top level goals, and the next level actions support the preconditions of the last level actions, and so on. Okay? This is what relaxed plan already did. The only extra thing that you have now is that the actions at any level cannot be mutually exclusive. So then no subset of actions chosen at any level can be mutually exclusive. If they are, then you have to backtrack and find another set. Okay? And if you do this, then when you stop, you would have actually gotten a valid plan. So you now suddenly have sound approach for computing a k-length plan. So if this planning graph is k levels deep, then you would get a k-step plan. If you are able to succeed, then you would get a k-step plan. Okay? If you fail, that means if you're unable to find a plan in k-steps, then you extend the planning graph one more level and search the whole thing again to see if you have a k+1-step plan. Okay? Now, on top of it, if you do mutual exclusion propagation, then the speed at which the search goes is significantly better. Because without mutual exclusion propagation, what happens essentially is you keep searching actions you keep putting actions in various levels until you get to the last level or some level where in fact those actions are statically mutually exclusive, at which point you have to start backtracking. With mutual exclusion propagation, you may be able to recognize this failure much earlier on. Failing first is always good. If you're going to fail anyway, fail first. Okay, because that saves a lot of effort. Okay, now, let me show you a nice animation for actually how the planning graph search works on graph plan. So here is a little graph, okay? And suppose that I want to support G1, G2, G3, G4. Okay? And suppose all these curved lines are essentially actions that have been marked mutually exclusive. Okay? Now, so here's the deal. So you mark, you take G1, G2, G3, G4. And so in this particular graph, I have to pick for each goal an action to support it. Right? So I picked A1, A2, A3, A4. Those are the only ones in this particular case, because each of them are only supported by one action. If there are multiple actions, then you actually have choices, and you have to consider all choices, non-deterministic choice. So, okay, in this case, all of them, A1, A2, A3, A4. And so if I pick A1, A2, A3, A4, then now in the next level, I have a recursive sub-goal. To make G1, G2, G3, G4, I have decided to select A1, A2, A3, A4 in this level, which means then I need P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, P6 to be satisfied. Okay? So what do? I just recursively do the same thing in the next level. It will become more interesting now. So for P1, I pick A5. Okay? And for P2, I pick A6. For P3, I pick A7. For P4, I pick A8. But then there's a problem. As soon as I pick A8 for P4, I notice that A7 and A8 and A6 are already marked mutually exclusive. Okay? So I need to backtrack. Okay? So now I backtrack. I basically, in this case, think of chronological backtracking first. Okay? So backtrack means the last decision I did, I undo it. The last decision I did was to support P4, okay, with A8. So that didn't work. So let me support P4 with A9. Okay? So now that also failed. Okay? In this case, that also failed. So that means something I did which basically got me into this black hole wherein P4 is unable to be supported. Okay? So now what do? I need to backtrack. If I'm doing chronological backtracking, which is a dumb backtracking, what do? I would go to P3 and look for a different guy. In this case, actually, P3 has nobody else. Okay? So if this fails, so you cannot look anything else for P3. So for P2, there is a different choice. So I'll do that, and so I get A11. Okay, so I basically picked A11 to support P2, and then I can pick A7 to support P3, then unfortunately I have a failure again. Okay, right? So at this point, essentially, I am unable to satisfy this subset of goals here. I couldn't. Okay, point one. So at this point, I have to backtrack across the levels, go here, and see if there is a different way of supporting these goals. Now, of course, if you're doing chronological backtracking, you'll again start from here. If there was a separate way of selecting G4, you'll pick that. Otherwise, you'll go up to G3, pick a different way, etc. That's a chronological backtracking. Okay, but more importantly, you know how the backtracking works in this case. Okay, now in this particular problem, you would fail because there is no other way of doing G1, G2, G3, G4. So you fail. So you extend the planning graph one more level, start the search all over again. Now here is the interesting thing: if you extend the planning graph this side, right? So this is ith iteration. In the I plus 1 iteration, you add more stuff on this side. Has anything here changed? No. Since nothing here has changed, and since you have gone and found that P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, P6 cannot be made true together, and similarly you figured out G1, G2, G3, G4 cannot be made true together in this level, that's a hard won knowledge. Right? You had to search to find out that something was not possible. And it's very much likely that it's very much possible that when you start from the next later levels, you may sub goal on G1, G2, G3, G4, and you would, at least you should avoid redoing this extra search again. Okay? So the standard graph plan algorithm has a little trick for it. What it does is, whenever you fail at any level, it remembers the entire subset of goals that you were trying to solve at that point as a memo. Remember that these can't be made true here. And if you ever try to make true a set of goals such that that set is a superset of any memo, there is a seed of failure in you, so you may as well say dead. Okay? This is the graph plan memos. Now notice that another way of thinking of graph plan memo, so this is a memo right now. Another way of thinking of graph plan memos are as NRE mutual exclusions. Because if the memo is too long, I'm sorry, if the memo is just two propositions, it's a binary mutex. If it is three propositions, it's a triary mutex. Okay, so memos essentially can be seen as picking up mutual exclusions of higher order. In fact, they can also be picking up mutual exclusions of binary nature, which the original binary mutual exclusion didn't capture. Because remember last class I pointed out that not all binary mutexes are going to be found. Because some binary mutexes at a level might be because of higher level mutexes in the previous level. Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, that's true too. So in fact, a particular goal cannot be made true. That is a memo too. And it's a hard won knowledge. So in fact, if you're trying to, make G1 true and you failed finally, it's worth remembering that G1 is failure. So that's one of the mutex. Okay? Again, one of the mutex of the hard kind, which actually comes up because of higher order mutexes at the previous level. The one of the mutex that comes up because of one of the mutex in the previous levels is easy. Okay? You would have computed it yourself. Now, so here is the story behind memos. Memos essentially tell us that a particular set of conditions cannot be achieved at a particular level k in the planning graph. And it makes sense to remember them because as you go forward in the planning graph, the previous part of the planning graph doesn't change. So, if something was not possible here, you may want to remember it because if you again try to do it, you can right away, declare failure and go. Okay? And memos can be thought of as computing higher order mutex relations, but they essentially are doing that on a demand driven fashion. Unlike mutual exclusion propagation rules that we did, okay, which actually do it upfront before any use is made, here you fail, you remember. So because you failed, you remember that mutual exclusion. So this is actually from a CSP point of view, from constraint satisfaction point of view, the mutual exclusion propagation corresponds to sort of a constraint propagation scheme where you do extra work upfront so that the later search will be easier. And the memoization corresponds to what has been called no good learning or explanation based learning, where what you're doing is after you fail, you remember. You know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So that's what this learning is. You know, don't fool me second time, I'm remembering now. You cannot fool me second time. Okay? So now as to which is better, so in fact, if you did not do mutual exclusion propagation and you only kept the static interferences, then the memos would detect, would basically discover some of the mutual exclusion later on. If you already did the mutual exclusion propagation, the memos are discovering those mutual exclusions that you didn't already propagate, which include higher order mutexes as well as the lower order mutexes that depend on higher order mutexes in the previous level. Okay. Now, here is the other interesting part, which is that just because you couldn't achieve P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, P6 together here doesn't mean that all of them are equally to be blamed. Okay, so one day I was wearing a red shirt, green pants, having my, you know, glasses on. I had drunk, you know, 10 glasses of whiskey. Then I got into a yellow car. I went on to 202, and then I got into a crash. Right? Now, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. So I want to remember that I don't want this to happen again. So what should I remember? Should I remember that never again, ever, ever again, use the red shirt, green pant, 10 glasses of whiskey, as well as 202, as well as everything else? Not really. The real reason I got into a crash is because of the 10 glasses of whiskey. So do 9 and then go on and then see if it works or not. Okay? But at least you are being smarter then. Okay? This is explanation-based learning. You are explaining your failure. You are explaining why the failure occurred. Okay? And if your explanations are bogus, you learn bogus rules. Okay? Don't laugh at this, because human civilization is full of bogus explanations. Okay? And so you try to avoid them. So you would say, well, if certain god becomes angry, certain amount of extra rain will fall. And this god seems to get angry when I don't give, you know, certain amount of, you know, gifts to this god. This whole thing is a bogus explanation, let's say. But if you believe in that explanation, you would want to stop the bad rain from falling by giving these gifts. Okay, so as far as you are concerned, you are thinking. Okay, you could also do, if in fact the explanation is in the context of complete theory, so you actually know the failure, and you can actually prove that this is the reason the failure occurred, that proof helps you significantly in cutting down what you are remembering. Yes, sir.
Isn't finding the proof or finding the bad guy, like the 10 glasses of whiskey, as hard as finding the fun?
No. So the idea is, it turns out that, so finding the, I'll punt your question, you know, because I have to think about it, okay? But oftentimes you can find much smaller explanations. The question is whether in fact, you know, I mean, so for example, you know, one of the things that you can do in this case is, just as part of this search, you can actually figure out which pieces here are making the failure happen. Okay. In particular, there was only so many failures that happened. This failure, this failure, this failure. Those were the only failures, and that was able to throw you out. So anybody who didn't take part, any decision which didn't take part in any of these failures, and by the way, that includes P5 and P6, you didn't even touch them. Right? You didn't even get to them before the failure occurred. And so in fact, you know at least that P5 and P6 are innocent. No, but you failed here in this particular case. So again, so here's the thing. So I figured out that, you know, it's, let's say, whiskey is the reason I got into the crash. So I stopped drinking whiskey. I still get into the crash. It's because you are driving on the road that day. So it's a different explanation. So now I have a different explanation. But it's still, I'm smarter than the first version I did, which is never again use red shirt, green pants, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so there may be another way you can pay. In fact, there was this classic joke that, you know, I have to remember, I may be able to paraphrase it, but so this guy stops drinking and it kills him. Why? Because one day he gets onto the road and a hansom cab came and just crashed into him and he died. Now you just say that's the reason, that basically shows that if you stop drinking, you get killed. Okay, there may be multiple ways of actually the failure occurring, but your point is very well taken. But all I'm saying is for this particular failure, these guys were not responsible. Okay? And let them be responsible once before saying they are actually, before saying that they are part of the problem. Okay? And this essentially, just a second. So this, what will happen is if you do this in the context of graph plan, this explanation-based learning in the context of graph plan, then instead of remembering, let's say, P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, P6, you actually only will remember P1, P2, P4 as the memo, which is significantly better. Right? Because you're more likely to be looking for a superset of P1, P2, P4 than to be looking for a superset of P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, P6. And so from the same failure, you are able to learn a lot more knowledge. Okay? And so that's the, and by the way, this is an easy way of getting NRE mutexes. Okay, if you feel like getting NRE mutexes and you don't want to do any extra work, do the following thing. If you have P and Q mutually exclusive in level I, then P, Q, and R are mutually exclusive. P, Q, R, M, W are also mutually exclusive. But those are the uninteresting NRE mutexes. So a good NRE mutex is one where it's mutually exclusive for all N of them, but any subset of them, any N minus 1 subset of them is still feasible. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because if I know one way to fail, I can do a lot of Baroque ornamentation around it, and they'll all fail. Okay, when I talk about N minus NRE mutexes as against binary mutexes, what I am talking about are those mutexes where that's the first time they become infeasible. Any subset of them is still feasible, but all of them together are not feasible. Okay? Okay, so now I get to remember these smaller memos, and it improves this search significantly if you want to do it. Okay? And in fact, so it is computing NRE mutexes, but these are the minimal NRE mutexes in some sense, because no subset of them will be guaranteed to be failing, whereas previously subsets of them are still already failing. Yes, sir. You can basically, in fact, once, so that's an interesting point, right? So once you have gone ahead and written memos onto this planning graph, right, it's not as useful really, but suppose it turns out that I was able to say G2, G3 is a memo. Then when I'm expanding, if there is an action A which depends upon G1 and G2, G3 as its preconditions, I won't put it in. That's useful. And furthermore, once I have already computed these memos, you could use set level heuristic better now. Because look for a level where no subset of these conditions are subsumed by a proven failure. Okay, I understand that memos are actually not all that easily available. Okay, but in fact, if you want to improve the informedness of the heuristic while keeping its admissibility, okay, one reasonable way to do it is to keep doing higher order mutexes like this, because any of those will improve your informedness, and they won't worsen your, they're still keeping your admissibility. Okay? So this idea of figuring out as part of the search who is actually responsible for your failure is, it's connected to several, you know, brand name ideas across AI. You can write this down: explanation based learning, no good learning, intelligent backtracking, and what is that thing called, CBJ, conflict directed back jumping. All of these do exactly the same thing, essentially. When you fail, you kind of figure out why did you fail. Okay? and use that to, so now not only can you remember, so in fact that idea of keeping track of what your failure is because of helps you in the following sense. So realizing that P3 has nothing to do with the failure, right? Remember when you started trying to give P4 its values, one value failed with P2, another value failed with P1. P3 is just an innocent bystander. Chronological backtracking will try to change the value of P3. Now, in this little example, you are lucky. P3 only has one value. I could easily have made an example where P3 has 10,000 outstanding values. And so you would be very happily trying all those values of P3 and failing again and again and again until you get out of P3. That's chronological backtracking. That's why it's called blind backtracking. Okay? Whereas, as soon as you realize P3 had nothing to do with it, and that's not too hard because one failure for P4, you remember when P4 failed, you remember who did it conflict with. One time it conflicted with P2. Another time it conflicted with P1. That's its conflict set. So when you have to backtrack, backtrack to the latest element in the conflict set. That's basically conflict-directed backtracking. Yes, sir. P3 is not responsible. What? Wait, let's see. What are you saying? No, P2, you did the decision on P2 first. I'm talking about P4. See, look at where we are right now, okay? So you were at that level, you came to P1, then P2, then you gave value to P3, then you gave a value to P4, there's a failure. This failure for P4 is because of P2, so I remember P2 as a conflict. Then I give the other value of P4, that also fails, that's because of P1. What? No, so all I'm saying is, no, at this point, P4 failed. If you're doing chronological backtracking, you would have to consider other values of P3 before you consider other values of P2. Yes. What? It's not enough. No, both are connected. That's my point. The same reasoning, I mean, your confusion comes from enlightenment, which is, the same reasoning you do to memo yourself from not repeating that failure, you can also use that reasoning to improve the backtracking. That's the point. Okay, so now if there were like 10,000 extra ways of doing P3 true, you would have been trying those. That was not necessary for this particular failure. That's called intelligent backtracking or dependency-directed backtracking. So, intelligent backtracking, dependency-directed backtracking, no good learning, explanation-based learning, conflict-directed backjumping, all of these are essentially just this. If you understand this, you understood all of them. Okay? It's just smart idea, you know. And it's basically, ultimately, you explain your failure and you try, based on that explanation, not to let that explanation ever happen again. Okay? And if you have, your theory is incomplete, so be it. But if your theory is complete, it's actually, and even if your theory is incomplete, sometimes it's useful. So for example, again, this is for planning, but in terms of the explanation and a failure, etc., for example, this is my favorite example, I might not know how exactly my car works, but I do know some things about how my car works. So for example, I know the paint of the car has nothing to do with whether or not it's going to start tomorrow morning. And don't laugh at it, because, you know, if I had no clue about cars, then everything about the car is dependent on everything else. So knowing that the paint of the car or the upholstery color have nothing to do with whether the car will start or not tomorrow is useful information. We kind of sometimes, you know, undersell our knowledge. And given that, you know, if you have partial knowledge, you can still explain by essentially removing. So one of the things that's happening here, for those of you who are into machine learning bent, there was a big failure involving these many things. All of these are features of failure, but only some of them are relevant features of failure. And removing things that are not, that can be shown to be relevant for the failure, is useful. Yes, yes. But all I'm saying in this particular case is for this particular failure, for this particular failure, none of these are relevant. Okay. Anyway, if you are interested in this sort of stuff, you know, there are, you know, papers that are in the reading list, or I can actually send mail to you. It's a very nice direction for search strategies in general. Okay. But it is most relevant here partly because it's connected to MEMOS. And in fact, if you do EBL, you get true NRE mutexes. I mean, the non-minimal NRE mutex. Okay. Mutex propagation was, this is all I said. MEMOS can be seen as NRE mutexes. Memoization could discover some of the mutexes found in mutex propagation. Difference is that the memoization is demand-driven. MEMOS are found after a failure. Mutex propagation is eager, and it's done before even the search starts. So how much do you want to do upfront versus how much do you want to do on demand is always a trade-off. Okay. Now, some more graph plan trivia. So you already know how the graph plan search works now, right? And you also know this stuff about MEMOS. One of the interesting things about MEMOS is the following thing. Remember that when I'm growing the planning graph, right, if it does not have any more mutexes between level I and level I plus 1, I know for sure that no more new mutexes will ever, I mean, no more mutexes will go away. So as far as the mutexes are concerned, this graph is leveled up. Here's my question. Suppose I have a problem. For that problem, the graph levels up as far as mutexes. So first of all, a graph levels up as far as without mutexes, that is just actions and propositions. It levels up at level 7. Okay? Doesn't matter. It's level 7. Where does it level off with mutexes? Below 7 or above 7? Above 7. Right? It has to be equal or above 7. Okay, so it levels off mutexes probably like 15, let's say. Now here's my question. Is there going to be a plan longer than 15 in this domain? Is there going to be a plan longer than 15? Because if there is no plan longer than 15, and if you haven't found a plan up until the 15th level, then you now have proved that the problem is unsolvable, which is good. No. So the point is, until now we never talked about how do you prove that a problem is unsolvable other than just exhausting the search space. Okay, if you do systematic search and exhaust the search space, yes. Now in the case of planning graph, I said keep expanding the levels until you know and you until you find a plan. Okay, so if you fail at ith level, you expand it to I plus 1th level. If you fail at I plus 1th level, you expand to I plus 2th level. When do you stop? Can you stop? If mutexes don't any longer change between level I and level I plus 1, can you stop and say that there is no plan? And to understand that, think about it this way. If actions didn't change from level I to level I plus 1, the actions and propositions didn't change from level I to level I plus 1, could you have declared that there is no plan at that point of time? No, because there could be two RM mutexes. And they stabilize later. Now, once you think of this reasoning, basically you can also say 3RE mutexes. Maybe 2RE mutexes are not going to change between level 15. I mean, after level 15, 2RE mutexes won't change. But then the 3RE mutexes could be changing. Maybe 4RE mutexes, maybe 5RE mutexes. So when can you be sure that you don't have to go any forward? MEMOS help. Okay. If there are no MEMOS changing between two levels, and you can think of mutexes as just special form of MEMOS, then you know that there is no point in searching anymore. And so the celebrated graph plan termination criterion essentially is that MEMOS also don't change. And the MEMOS, of course, can be NRE mutexes. And no more mutexes are changing. So that's another reason why MEMOS are interesting, because you know nobody really tries to prove termination this way. Okay. In fact, planners are very bad at dealing with unsolvable problems. It's easier to solvable problems. That's hard enough, because at least solvable problems, you don't have to exhaust the search space. In essence, you're exhausting the search space here. Okay. So another kind of a thing, connection with respect to planning graph and graph plan, is you can think of the process of extracting the plan from the planning graph in the planning graph. Is so here is the deal. So you have a planning graph like this, right? I'm sorry, let me go to the previous one. Okay, here is a planning graph like this. And I'm looking for a subgraph. So for example, the green one is a subgraph of this planning graph. It would be valid, right, if no NRE mutexes hold on that path. Okay, and even though you only connect, so as I said, the requirement is only that you mark all the static interferences. That means 2RE direct static interferences between actions. That's the only thing you need. But the search then makes sure that the only graph, any graph that you found, is guaranteed not to have any NRE mutexes. Okay, if you did compute all the NRE mutexes, you would still have found that is the case. Okay, so in some sense, think of extraction of the plan as verifying that at least one execution thread is devoid of NRE mutexes. Okay, as long as we mark statically interfering actions, graph plan backward search will be sound. And everything else is to improve efficiency. Okay? And then this is the termination criterion that I talked about just now. Okay. Graph plan and optimality, I talked about it last time. Essentially, graph plan is not optimal out of the box because it optimizes steps, not the number of actions. Okay? So you can think of optimality under various conditions. Step optimality is sort of weakly related to make span. Make span is from the beginning to the end. You know, if you consider, so one of the things is if you have a schedule of, you know, doing bunch of actions together, then a make span essentially is from the beginning of this plan to the end, when the last task ends, how much time did you spend? In between, sometimes there may be five tasks that are executing in parallel, and you don't count it multiple times. It's all the same time. Do you understand what I'm saying? So make span essentially talks about from the beginning to the end. So step optimality is sort of related to make span of a parallel plan. Except normally make span makes sense when actions have durations. That's when we think about it. So I start boiling the water. Okay, suppose I'm doing cooking. I don't ever do cooking sequentially. That's why we have, even, you know, poor students will have, you know, these cooking ranges which have four stoves on them. So you start four things in parallel. Okay, because some things will take longer time to boil. By the time it boils, you have done something else and you combine them, etc. Okay, so the make span, I mean, the total time taken for cooking is from the time you went into the kitchen to the time you got out and said, yeah, now can go back to TV, right? And the question is, in between, you can do lots and lots of parallelism. Now, the parallelism makes sense because the actions have duration. In fact, okay. So you could try to hand wave and say, oh no, step optimality is like make span, but really, graph plan that I described to you till now is really only going to work for instantaneous actions. Okay, and if you start having temporal actions, there are various things that you have to do. Durative actions, you have to do various things. So for instantaneous actions, this sort of makes not too much sense. Then there is a length optimality, which is related to the number of actions. That you can make planning graph plan give you minimum number of actions. As I said, all you need to do is to mark every pair of actions mutually exclusive, every pair of non-no-op actions mutually exclusive, plus also a no-op and non-no-op might become mutually exclusive because of propagation. If you do that, then you are essentially ensuring that you will, in the subgraph you pick, there will never be more than one real action per level. So it's a sequential plan. Then the number of actions will exactly be the length of the plan. I mean, the number of steps is equal to the number of actions. So it will be the length of the plan. Now, the problem with that is, for many domains, actually, graph plan might be able to be done in two steps. Okay, if you allow parallelism, but will require 200 steps if you require sequentiality. Okay, and I'll show you an example in a minute. Consider the following kind of a scenario. So I have one action G1, and I made up this dummy domain. Okay, one action G1. There is one goal G1. There are two actions A and B which give G1. I made up this domain myself. Okay, and A requires P1 to P1000 as the precondition. And the domain is such that there are single actions O1 to O1000 that give P1 to P1000 one by one. Okay? And they don't kill each other. Basically, that's the only thing. O1, all it does, it doesn't need anything, it gives you P1. O2 doesn't need anything, gives you P2. And then there is this other guy, B, which gives G1, it requires Q. There's only one action C which gives Q, but it requires J. And there is only one action D which gives J and does nothing else. So clearly, this is a plan, this is a plan. This plan has 1001 actions. This plan has 3 actions. Which will graph plan point, if you allow parallelism? That one. And it says, thank God I'm done, because I'm done in 2 levels. To find this, right, it needs to go 3 levels. Okay, now in this case it was 3 levels, right, but I could have also made it instead of 3 action plan, because I was writing it myself, I made my life simple. This 3 is bigger than 2 steps, that's all. But it could be anything less than 1001. So 1000, I could have a 1000 long sequential plan, which will still be more optimal than this 1001 action plan. And imagine graph plan trying to find a 1000 long sequential plan. It will have to do 1 level, 2 level, 3 level, 4 level, all the way up to 1000 levels. And it dies, you know, you would die or it will die somewhere around 4th level or 10th level. Okay, so finding sequentially optimal plans by graph plan is not that easy. Okay, but it's the real cost of finding sequentially optimal plans, you know. So you cannot say, well, since I can find these, I will say that's what is optimality. That makes no sense. Okay. Now, what's more interesting is there's a third, probably a more useful notion of optimality called cost optimality. Each action has some real number as its cost, positive real number as its cost. And what I want is a plan that has a total cumulative cost, which is the lowest. Now what? Now can graph plan even find the plan? Because the problem then is there is no connection to the way the graph is expanded, planning graph is expanded, and the costs of the actions. You expand the graph based on what is applicable. Costs have nothing to do with applicability. So it turns out that if you have cost optimality, you can't just stop at the level at which the graph plan finds the solution. You have to continue. You have to really do a sort of a branch and bound search. Okay. Now, having made it look as if graph plan is a bad guy, the question is it actually easier algorithmically for, let's say, a progression planner to find an optimal plan in terms of cost optimality? Yes. At least I don't have to do anything. All I need to do is an admissible heuristic. And the max would be admissible heuristic, set level would be admissible heuristic, zero would be admissible heuristic. You do A star search with admissible heuristic, you will find optimal solution. Okay? Okay, now of course, we will talk about, after this all is over, we will talk about actually looking at costs for actions and utilities for goals, which is a more interesting planning. In the same classical planning, now actions have costs, utility, and goals have utilities. And what's more interesting, if the utilities, the costs, so the goals have two different kinds of interactions oftentimes. If you make this goal true, making this goal true becomes harder or easier. And those are cost-oriented interactions. And then there is other issue of if you already made this goal true, having this goal true gives you how much extra utility? It could be a large utility, less utility, or no difference. Okay. Now, why is that important? For example, left shoe, right shoe. Okay. Suppose there are two goals, left shoe and right shoe. Okay. This is like a Visa commercial, right? So if you have left shoe, 0 point. I mean, it's probably not particularly useful. Have just right shoe, not particularly useful. You have both, it's priceless, right? You have actual shoes. Okay. So there is utility interaction. So that both of them give you a lot more utility than any one of them. And you can have it the opposite way too. One car, certain amount of utility. Two cars, not double the utility. 15 cars in your garage, you will be spending time trying to find parking place for it. So in fact, the utility has reduced now. Okay, so we will talk about this kind of planning where goals have utility interactions and actions have costs, and then how do you do optimal plans there. That's called partial satisfaction planning, and we'll look at that later. Okay, but with respect to all, even with respect to cost optimality, it's harder to make graph plan be cost optimal. Okay. Any question? Yes, sir.
Can you talk about how to configure graph plan in the
final plan? We will later, much later. I mean, at the end of these slides, I will talk about it. Okay. I'm happy that you asked me that question. It makes me happy because I do want to think about it, but I won't talk about it right now. But we are closer conceptually to something else altogether, which is, as long as you're trying to find a subgraph of a graph structure, which is a finite graph, it's a combinatorial problem. There are only a finite number of subgraphs, and one of them has a useful property, and find it. Okay, so any combinatorial substrate, so basically take the lazy way out. Why should you be solving the problem? Why not give it to somebody else? Okay, so the idea would be, just think of from the planning side itself. Suppose you're doing the planning graph, but rather than do this backward search with MIMOs, with explanation-based learning, all that stuff, I say to heck with it. I will do the planning graph, I'll then ship it into a CSP or a SAT or integer programming solver. And they'll do their thing. They'll find me a subgraph of it, and if they can find it, if not, they will fail, in which case I'll, you know, do next level planning graph, ship it all, compile it down to IP or CSP or SAT, and solve it again. Okay, this should not be surprising at all because it's a combinatorial problem. You should be able to do it. Okay? So here is the question, how would I compile it to SAT? I'll start talking about it as compiling it to SAT in this case, okay? And I'll assume I have the planning graph structure in front of me. So a SAT, of course, is a set of propositions and a set of clauses, right? And basically, your idea is to find an interpretation of the propositions, true, false values for the propositions, such that all clauses are satisfied. That's what satisfiability problem is. And there are very good SAT solvers out there because this problem is of interest independently to too many people, right? And so there is SAT solvers out there. Similarly, there are CSP solvers, there are IP solvers. So one good thing is we just convert our problem into something that can be solved by one of these solvers. So the question is, how would I solve it? How would I convert it? First thing you should know is any combinatorial problem can be converted into any other combinatorial problem. So you should start knowing that it can be done. You shouldn't be surprised that it can be done. It's just a question of figuring out the details. Okay? So it turns out the details aren't that hard. Okay? All I need to do is, so there are unitary clauses and the larger clauses. So the unitary clauses are, so first of all, if I have a planning graph like this, this is a different planning graph. Okay? But so I have some propositions in the initial state, okay, some literals, and then some literals in the next state, some literals in the next state, and there are these connections, you know, and there are these mutual exclusions in the magenta color. Okay, so first thing I know is if, because a literal appearing at different levels is a different literal. So if I have FBE in this level, it's FBE0. If it appears here, it's FBE1. If it appears here, it's FBE2. So the number of propositions basically is the number of literals times the number of levels plus the number of actions times the number of levels. That's the total number of propositions. Okay, SAT plan is the kind of thing that you should not be asked to do on the exam, but I will, because it's painful to, you know, it's like saying, here's a high-level C program, write the compiler code for it. I mean, write the assembly code for it. We just do it. We write compilers such that they write it. Okay? If you look at those in assembly programs, they're ugly. SAT is the assembly version of this nice graph. So it'll be painful to write it. So the question is, what are the simple ways each of these will be converted? So you have, for every one of these are true, right? At R is 0, at A is 0, at B is 0. So by the way, first of all, finding a solution for a SAT is basically finding a model. So one thing you want to keep in mind is you are converting planning into model finding. Converting planning into model finding. In general, any combinatorial problem finds a model. Okay. Now one interesting thing, of course, is not the full planning problem. If we converted full planning problem into model finding, then planning problem should be also NP-complete. It's actually bounded length planning problem. All we are able to say is, if I grew the planning graph to K levels, I can convert it into a SAT instance. And if that SAT instance has a solution, then there's a K-length plan. If it has no solution, that means there is no K-length plan. So that's why it's that first word that I said, bounded length planning as model finding. That's the background on that. Okay? So I will say these guys must be true in every model. At R is 0 must be true because it's true. Okay? And at A is 0 must be true, at B is 0 must be true. And similarly, whatever are the goals, you know, in A and in B must be true. That's, let's say, my goals. So in A1 and in B1 must be true. So to make sure that every model will have those propositions true, all you need to write is unitary clauses with those propositions. That's it. So this is one, and you know, remember the clauses are normally, you do CNF clauses. So this is one clause, this is another clause, this is another clause, this is another clause, this is another clause. And then the next thing is converting the graph into a bunch of SAT clauses. Okay, how would I do that? If I need a condition K here, if I need it, then one of the guys that can support this should be, one of the guys that can support it should be present. Right? Okay? So I will just say, if in A1 is required, then load A1 must be true, because in this particular case, in A1 is only supported by load A1. In general, if in A1 is required, then all the actions that are supporting it, one of them must be true. So you write, you know, if this G is required, you know, A1 or A2 or A3 or A4, where A1, A2, A3, A4 are in the planning graph such that they are drawing lines to this. Right? Okay? And so these are the conditions for that particular graph. The next thing is, if an action is present, its preconditions must be present. Now notice that actions are propositions, preconditions are also propositions. All of them are normal SAT propositions. Okay? So just as you said, if a condition must be true here, one of the supporting actions must be true, which is these green clauses. I also have these brown clauses which say, if an action must be true, then all its preconditions must be true in the next level, in the previous level. Okay? These are just writing. This is blind writing. Okay, you write one after other. It's painful for humans, but it's just very fast for computers. Okay, you're not solving the problem. You're just compiling. You're taking C program, converting into assembly program. You're converting graph into, you know, SAT. Okay? And then the only thing that's left is mutual exclusion condition. So I converted the graph structure with these greens, and I converted the initial and goal states with these. So the only thing that's left is the mutual exclusion, right? What do I do? So if I say two things cannot both be true together, that's all I have to say. So it's not P or not Q. One of them must be false. That's all I'm saying. It's not that one of them, at least one is true. It's only that one of them must be false. If P is mutually exclusive with Q, that means either P is false or Q is false. Okay? So for every mutual exclusion condition, I will write of the form not in A1 or not at RM1. That's it. These are the conditions. For this little problem, these are only these many. For For a normal size problem, you know, this SAT instance would be quite large. Yeah, the implications to a CNF is not that hard.
Yeah,
but I mean, you take these, convert to CNF, and then you have, you know, SAT solvers can eat that. Now, why is this interesting? Do you expect this to be faster than solving planning graph by that nice little backward search algorithm? Why? The interesting thing is that, so what are the costs? The costs are, of course, you compile. There's a compilation cost. And furthermore, there's a memory cost. These instances, especially the SAT compiled instances, should be kept in the memory, you know, disk or memory. Okay? And to be running faster, you might want to keep it in the memory. So in fact, it can take pretty large space. Okay? You know, whether you keep it in memory, main, or disk. Okay? This size is much bigger than the graph size, because graph is essentially implicit representation. Now, why would I want to do this? What's the positive part is? Positive part is A, laziness. I don't have to make those previous algorithms. If I knew this, if I knew somebody else can solve my problem, why should I solve it myself? Point one. Okay? Point two, they could actually solve it better, it turns out. Okay? Why? Because as intuitively plausible as it sounds to find a subgraph starting from this and going level by level backwards, there is no reason that finding subgraph that's valid most efficiently would involve going from the back and going to the front. It could start anywhere and go any direction. Once you converted that graph into a SAT instance, the SAT guy doesn't know that these are coming from here, these are coming from here. It doesn't even know what are action propositions, what are, it's basically all the structure is lost now. So that could be a bug or a feature. Okay, it's actually partly a bug, but part of the feature part of it is now it might, in the very beginning of the search, it might start giving a value for one of these variables to be true and trying that branch first. That would be like non-directional search, where you're trying to compute a subgraph by starting in the middle and growing both directions. That could be faster. Now, what's the proof? Proof is in the pudding. Okay, essentially, SAT plan kicks graph plan pretty badly. Okay? And in fact, when SAT plan idea came along, basically they converted planning graph into SAT instance. It was suggested by several of the people. And then when they did convert it, they were able to solve it much faster. And so, in fact, the paper for showing they will win this competition. So it's like Obama about to win New Hampshire primary, until, you know, they found that people don't necessarily say what they want to do. And so, you know, SAT plan was supposed to win the 1998 planning competition, because the papers leading to that competition, SAT plan had all these nice examples showing, you know, you can solve large problems faster than graph plans on that word search. Okay. Now the SAT plan is essentially planning graph plus SAT compilation. That's all. Okay. Now what happened in the competition itself was they were running all their versions in AT&T, which those days used to be a rich company, and in those days, in 1998, they had Sun workstations with 8 gigabyte RAM. Right now, you know, middle school children have workstations with 8 gigabyte RAM, but those days, I used to have maybe, you know, half a megabyte RAM, I don't remember anyway. But what happened was they were used to this having nice big memory, and then competition guy said everybody gets the same machine, and it had as high as 32 megabytes RAM. So SAT plan never started. It couldn't compile because there is no place to hold. Right? And they could have written the program separately such that it will put it in the secondary memory, etc., etc. All that stuff could be done. But, you know, it was one of these historical side notes, historical as in 1998 side note, that SAT plan failed, even though all papers showed that SAT plan should win. But that tells you something. It tells you that when you convert it into SAT, it's an explicit representation. And sometimes memory can be a problem. Okay? And in fact, one interesting way to convert the planning graph, so if you keep planning graph as planning graph, then it's an implicit representation. So memory costs are very low. Now, of course, you can see what SAT is doing and then try to write a search for the planning graph directly, which is no longer backward search, which starts in the middle and goes all directions. Papers have been written on that, and they are faster. The advantage of doing it to SAT is, since so many people are interested in SAT compilers, in SAT solvers, that you can just convert it once and then sit around, and every year there'll be a new SAT solver that's faster than the previous years. Whereas, you know, the guy who does it on the planning graph has to keep writing new algorithms to keep up with the nice ideas that they've been having. However, one thing is, if planning graph is implicit and does take much less space, and graph plans, and the SAT compilation takes much more space, are there other combinatorial substrates that can take less space? And in fact, what we'll talk about next time when we come back is that you can convert into CSP. SAT is a CSP, right? SAT is a CSP where all variables have Boolean. They're all Boolean values. But you can also write it as a real CSP, which is multi-valued. One advantage is that most of the